Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We've sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them in with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organization that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them. Links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
Welcome everybody to this session. I'm hugely excited about this personally because it's a subject close to my heart. I'm going to introduce Dr. Gandhi in just a moment, but before we do, we're going to have a video from our sponsors. We're actually sponsoring a charity on this channel, Forests Without Frontiers, so we'll have a message from them to tell you all about what they're doing. Okay, so if we could on the video, that'd be great.
Hi, this is Anka. Sorry, Adrian. I thought you were running this because my uploads
are so bad. Sorry, you're quite correct. Okay. We'll do that at the end, don't worry. I'd completely forgotten about that. So let's launch straight in and we'll drop that in at the end.
I'll post the link anyways.
Okay, thank you. So welcome to this session. We have Dr. Sam Gandhi. Sam has a PhD in ecological sciences. He's a lifelong nature lover and he's currently working at the Synthesis Institute, where they are creating tailored nature-based practices for people undergoing psilocybin therapy, particularly for depression. So we'll be drawing on all of that experience in his talk today. And without further ado, we'll go straight over to Sam. Welcome and thank you.
Thanks, Adrian. Thanks for having me. Great to be here. I'm just going to share my presentation and get that up. Cool. Okay, I'm going to be talking about the potential of psychedelic substances as agents of nature connection. Psychedelics are, I guess at this time, controversial substances. They come with cultural baggage and people tend to have prior conceptions about them. And I would ask you kindly to sort of suspend any prior judgments or conceptions for the duration of this talk and just listen with an open and yet rational mind. So I'd just like to start by mentioning a few key terms, which I think can kind of help sort of set the scene of this. So there's this concept of biophilia developed by famed biologist E.O. Wilson, and he defined it as the connections that human beings subconsciously seek with the rest of life. Our species has spent almost its entire existence living in natural environments, so it's likely we have an innate evolutionary preference for them. A never useful term is the overview effect. So these are experiences, cognitive experiences reported by the astronauts when viewing the Earth from space. So feelings of wonder and awe, unity with nature, universal brotherhood, and transcendence. Many of the astronauts that come away from sort of this powerful experience, they view the Earth as something incredibly precious and fragile that must be preserved. And so, yeah, this kind of ecological awareness or this reframing is really beautifully summarized by the taker of this photograph, actually, NASA astronaut Bill Anders. We came all this way to explore the moon, and the most important thing is that we discovered the Earth. So just to define nature connectedness or nature relatedness, as it's also known in the literature, this is something specific, and it's referring to our self-identification with nature, our sense of felt oneness with nature, the degree to which we see ourselves as part of the natural world. And it's associated with many different measures of psychological well-being, including vitality, life satisfaction, lowered anxiety. It's also an important mediator for some of the benefits we obtain from spending time in nature, such as attentional capacity, mood improvements, ability to reflect on a life problem. People who rate high in nature connectedness following contact with nature tend to sort of experience more life satisfaction, have more transcendent and awe-inspiring experiences, and are more likely to place greater value on intrinsic rather than extrinsic aspirations. So intrinsic things cover sort of things like self-development and community and connection to others, whereas extrinsic aspirations are things like fame and social status and money. It's also important to note that nature connectedness is a strong predictor for actually spending time in nature and the value you place on it. And nature contact is associated itself with a broad array of mental and physical health benefits. And yeah, just to get across how important nature connectedness is for our psychological well-being. So this is from a study that was published earlier this year. And it looked at specifically at eudaimonic well-being, which covers things such as the pursuit of excellence and self-actualization and vitality, things like that. And this study found that nature connectedness predicted 4 times more strongly people's well-being than their socioeconomic status. Obviously, this is a more recent cultural invention, whereas our connection to nature is something much, much deeper and more ancient. Importantly, given our current times, numerous studies have also found that nature connectedness is a strong psychological predictor of pro-environmental behavior. We are growing increasingly disconnected from the natural world. This has been happening over millennia and centuries, but seems to be speeding up now. It likely began with farming, the moving away from a hunter-gatherer existence to farming particular species to the exclusion of others. It sort of changed our relationship and how we viewed and valued nature. More as time went on, as a result of our farming methods, partly we started living in cities, in large population centers. And with that followed greater urbanization. So our sort of separation from nature increased further. The most recent wave of disconnection seems to be occurring through the increasing advent of electronic technology, entertainment technology, and smartphones into our lives. This disconnection from nature, I see as fundamentally stemming from the success of our materialistic technological civilization. It's one of the most dangerous consequences of our current civilization. And this is, our current global ecological crisis, I feel, is stemming from this. So there was a report published last year, which was the most comprehensive of its kind ever undertaken, the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. So I think it was 145 expert scientific authors from 50 different countries looked over 50 years worth of data, and the picture it painted was grim. Nature and our ecosystems are declining and sort of being degraded at rates unprecedented in human history. And these rates of decline and degradation are accelerating, with a million species threatened with extinction. And the conclusion of this report is that without a full-scale ecological mobilization on the scale of World War II, we are in deep, deep trouble. So in light of this, is our destiny as a species to continue on this current path? Are we destined to destroy much of the life that shares this planet with us, and inadvertently, and by extension, ourselves? Or is there a different path that we can take? A quote attributed to Albert Einstein is that we cannot hope to solve problems with the same level of consciousness that created them. One of the few positive findings of this report I mentioned is that areas under the management or inhabited by indigenous people were the only areas not undergoing ecological degradation. And in fact, some areas inhabited by indigenous people can harbour more biodiversity than the national parks that don't have any humans at all. So one of the things linking all these indigenous groups is they are very deeply connected to nature, to their environment, and they tend to have a more group-centered existence, much less individualistic than us in the West. Some of these groups, not all, but some, use psychedelic substances and have a long history of doing so. So the disconnection that we experience from nature that is just but one form of disconnection. And there's a wider frontier of disconnection occurring. Disconnection from self, disconnection with others, disconnection from the world at large. And this seems to be fueling a mental health crisis as well. And it's interesting to note, so some of the work from Imperial College by my friend Dr. Roz Watts on psilocybin, she found through her qualitative research that people with depression describe feeling disconnected. They describe this broad state of disconnection, and that the psilocybin worked in part by facilitating this greater connection. So it seems that psychedelics can act as agents of connection, which I'll get to more later. So now, looking at nature connectedness in particular, there's a few studies that have shown that sort of total lifetime usage of classical psychedelics strongly predicts nature connectedness levels at baseline. It's also interesting to note that psilocybin has been found to catalyze long-term increases in nature connectedness, lasting at least a year, if not longer, and also positive changes to people's relationship to nature and the environment. And the really sort of interesting thing about this is that this is even when psilocybin is administered in clinical settings lacking in nature. It can be quite challenging to increase nature connectedness. It's quite a deeply held and stable trait, it seems, and the literature reports a variety of things. So some studies find that passive contact with nature can increase it. Other studies say, well, maybe this is just a transient fleeting thing, and other studies show that there's no change. And just to put this into sort of perspective, there's one study sort of encountered recently where there was this nature intervention where people had half an hour of nature time for 30 days, and as expected, there were broad increases in measures of well-being and mindfulness and things like that. But interestingly, no change to people's nature connectedness. And yet here in these studies, a single experience or a few experiences with psilocybin in a clinical setting lacking in nature can cause this sustained, enduring increase in people's connectedness to nature. And as far as I'm aware, that is completely novel and unique to psychedelics. There's nothing else in the nature connection literature that comes close to that, as far as I'm aware. We can also see, this is some yet unpublished research from Imperial College, from this study giving psilocybin to healthy psychedelic naive people and looking at the sort of the brain and psychological effects. And here we can see at 3 months after a high dose of psilocybin, the increase in connectedness to nature is substantial and highly significant and sustained. But what's interesting here is it's coming via a different pathway to some of the other psychological benefits of psychedelics, such as psychological insight that the experience can confer. So this suggests that more could be done to potentially maximize this. So this is some of my own research I was involved in at Imperial College. And we did a prospective survey looking at people's psychedelic usage. And we looked at sort of took measures of nature relatedness before, and then sort of 2 and 4 weeks, and then 2 years afterwards to get these longitudinal snapshots in time to see where people were. And we found a few interesting things. We found this very clear effect of total lifetime usage of psychedelics on people's baseline nature relatedness. But we also found for people who'd never taken a psychedelic before, that even after a single experience, there was an increase in people's nature relatedness. We also found that two of the positive predictors of nature relatedness increases were access to and the perceived importance of natural settings, in addition to experiences of ego dissolution. And here are some accounts from some of the psilocybin research that gives an idea of how this nature connectedness may be experienced. Before I enjoyed nature, now I feel part of it. Before I was looking at it as a thing, like TV or a painting. You're part of it, there's no separation or distinction, you are it. I felt like sunshine twinkling through leaves, I was nature. So the ego dissolution experience I just mentioned, this appears to be an important mechanism by which psychedelics can increase nature connectedness. So as well as the research study I was involved in, there was an older retrospective study looking at past psychedelic use back in time, and that also found ego dissolution was an important factor. And this sort of this is an interesting image that sort of came out of the Imperial research, and it's sort of representing the different brain regions all becoming hyperconnected in the under the psilocybin. And so under a high dose of psilocybin, the default mode network, which is thought to be a fundamental sort of basis for the ego or the sense of subjective self-identity, that kind of dissolves and breaks down. And so the sort of the perceived boundary between self and other, or self and nature, kind of dissolves, and it can facilitate this expanded state of self-other, self-nature overlap. And that seems to leave an indelible mark with people and affect their perspective from that time on, potentially, or in long term. There was an interesting study published early this year that looked at people's first psychedelic experiences. So this was a study conducted in Finland, and it found that it wanted to look at people's first psychedelic experiences and the mystical type experiences that could be part of them to see what were the outcomes. And one of the most common outcomes, interestingly, from a psychedelic mystical experience was a greater or deeper connection, positive connection to nature. And this is interesting, as the mystical experience is one of the key mechanisms by which psychedelics can yield long-term benefits to mental health in both clinical and healthy populations. And it's interesting to note that natural settings seem quite prone to eliciting mystical and transcendent experiences. It's interesting to note that psilocybin has been shown in a few studies now that it has the capacity to alter the personality trait openness to experience, which is one of the big five personality traits, and it can also reduce neuroticism. So this is important because openness, as the sort of personality traits go, is particularly strongly correlated with nature connectedness and also pro-environmental behavior. And neuroticism is an interesting one, that it has the power to lower that, because the lower one's neuroticism is, the more likely they are to gain greater psychological benefits from nature. So there's been some research on ayahuasca users as well. So this is an Amazonian psychedelic brew, and it's been found that the ayahuasca users rate more highly in self-transcendence. So this is a particular trait that encompasses feelings of transcending the self to a broader, more universal, cosmic or spiritual sense of oneness. And it's related to openness. And it too is a significant predictor of nature connectedness and environmental concern. There are a number of interesting, overlapping and potentially synergistic mechanisms by which nature contact and psychedelics can potentially yield benefits to mental health. So both psilocybin and time in nature can reduce rumination in the default mode network of the brain. So rumination, or that sort of like looping negative thoughts, are associated with major depression and things like post-traumatic stress disorder. At the same time, nature and psychedelics have also been found to increase connectedness in a broad sense. So not just to nature itself, but simply acknowledging nature can increase broad level psychological connectedness. So there's a few other interesting overlaps, including awe. And this is probably an important one underlying the effects of nature and psychedelics. So the feeling of awe is essentially boiled down to the feeling of being very small in reference to something much bigger than oneself. And awe, that experience comes with a lot of psychological benefits. So there's some interesting research coming out of Yale recently looking at sort of nature immersion for military veterans with severe post-traumatic stress disorder, and it found that prolonged time in nature was really quite helpful to this population. And they found that of all the emotions and experiences, awe was perhaps the central one. So I envisage perhaps in the future that nature immersion and psychedelic therapy could be essentially combined to yield a form of awe therapy, which could be helpful for some people. And it's interesting to note that the experience of awe is closely linked to feelings of spirituality, as is nature connection. A central cornerstone of both ecology and spiritual views is the feeling of interconnection. Interconnectedness is a core facet of both. I see ecology is the scientific comprehension of the interconnection of living systems, and spirituality or psychedelic experiences are sort of a direct experiential comprehension. So they're different pathways to the same knowledge, essentially. Psychedelics also have the potential to increase mindfulness related capacities in a sustained way. And this is interesting because mindfulness and nature connectedness are closely linked. So to the point where if you increase one, you're likely to increase the other. And it should also be noted as well that being in natural settings can sort of naturally precipitate states of mindful absorption and present moment focus. The near-death experience too, some of the long-term effects of people going through this experience are increased appreciation for nature and environmental concern. So this hints that this increased connection to and love for nature and concern and desire to protect it is part of a universal transcendent human experience. So given what we know about nature and psychedelics and the potential synergy and overlap between them, there are a number of ways we can sort of maximize potentially the benefits of both. So some psychedelic research has used journaling in a spiritual context. And it seems that when certain practices are kind of like supplemented or added on to psychedelic experiences, they magnify the long-term psychological gains one experiences. So there's some research showing that simply journaling about what you enjoy or love about nature and making a note of anything you enjoy and writing it down can increase nature connectedness in a sustained way. So I see this, a very simple intervention like this could be used alongside psychedelic therapy to increase nature connectedness. There's also the potential for incorporating things like Shinrin Yoku, like Japanese forest bathing, which is essentially an active mindfulness practice conducted in woodland environments that sort of gets one out of the head and sort of into the environment and tuned in to their various senses by sort of slowing down a bit and taking it all in. There's also the possibility of using some horticultural therapy exercises, such as, say, tilling the soil or tending the soil before your session, then maybe planting a seed. Following the psychedelic session, you have insights that you then work to sort of ground and embed in your life, and they need kind of nourishing and sustaining. So taking away this seed that you then grow could be a good sort of side of that. At the same time, yeah, it's not likely at this time or feasible, certainly not legal in the UK, to sort of take people out into nature during an actual psychedelic experience. But if you can't take people out of the clinic themselves, why not bring more nature into the clinic itself? And another option would be like to have psychedelic heat like centers in nature-based settings, in woodland environments, you know, with nice windows and skylights. And then you can kind of, it could, the amount of nature contact could be sort of titrated based on the needs of the person undergoing the session. So there's many ways potentially that nature can be incorporated safely into people's psychedelic sessions. And in doing so, there's a tremendous potential here to sort of facilitate perhaps a growth in pro-environmental awareness. So these are the words of Theodore Roszak, who's one of the founding fathers of eco-psychology. And he said this at a conference around 30 years ago over now. And he said, if the self is expanded to include the natural world, behavior leading to destruction of the world will be experienced as self-destruction. This is a view shared by the inventor and discoverer of LSD and the discoverer of psilocybin, Albert Hofmann. So Albert came to view the potential of psychedelics to reconnect our nature-alienated species to the biosphere. They're perhaps the most fundamental property. And at the mighty age of 101, he said, alienation from nature and the loss of the experience of being part of the living creation is the greatest tragedy of our materialistic era. It is the causative reason for ecological devastation and climate change. Therefore, I attribute absolute highest importance to consciousness change. I regard psychedelics as catalyzers for this. Psychedelics are not a panacea. They are not a magic bullet. They are not going to do the hard work of restoring and regenerating the increasingly degraded biosphere, but they are or can be catalysts of connection. At the level of the neuron, they induce neurons to sprout new synaptic and dendritic connections. At the level of the brain, they increase global brain connectivity, so linking up different brain regions. They can increase connection to self, to others, to world and nature and to the universe itself. So they have a tremendous, if used with care and used well, they could be very useful tools in remedying our increasing disconnection. Thank you.
That was lovely. Thank you very much. That was such a good overview of the research on this, and you brought in so many different elements of what's been going on. So we've got a couple of questions from people. And if you do have a question, pop it in the Q&A box down the bottom and we'll look at those. So let's just see what we got in there. Interesting one. We'll see how you go with this. How do you suggest individuals with unintegrated psychedelic experience address those difficult experiences?
Ooh, good question. You know what? Like, so my friend, Dr. Roz Watts, who's a psychedelic therapist, she would be much better to answer that than I. I'm not a therapist. I'm a researcher. So I don't feel like I'm best equipped to answer that question, if I'm honest. I think there's other people who would be more informed than I to answer that, if I'm honest.
Okay, thank you. Is there a book where I can read more about the different types of psychedelica and their use and effect? Which psychedelic would you recommend?
So, I mean, there are quite a few books out there on this. I think two of the ones that I sort of got me interested sort of way back now, there's one called the Psychedelics Encyclopedia, which is like, it was sort of, I think, in the 60s or 70s, and it might have had a reprint, but it's kind of a good resource. But yeah, as I say, quite old school now. There's a great book, Plants of the Gods, and that's by Albert Hofmann and Richard Ivan Schulte, one of the founding fathers of ethnobotany, and a never Christian Ratch, a never ethnobotanist. So yeah, three very formidable minds pooling their sort of brain power into sort of a great overview of not just psychedelic plants, but sort of other psychoactive, powerful psychoactive plants as well. So that's great for a sort of an overview of the history and of the science. Yeah, those books, sort of, that's what's springing to mind now, but I'm sure there are others as well. I would kind of like, yeah, maybe have a Psychedelic Press published books, Muswell Hill Press, Amazon as well. Maybe have a little Google and maybe check out reviews and stuff from people. There's a great book by a guy called Dale Pendle, who sadly died last year. I can't remember the name of it, but if you do an author search for some of his books, I really enjoyed one of his books.
Just saw Ben Sessa's book as well that came out a couple of years ago. Is that?
Yes. Oh yeah, good shout. Was that on the psychedelic renaissance?
That's the one.
Yes, that right. might be. I've not read that, but that might be a good sort of more modern book to kind of bring one up to speed with what's going on at this time.
So that's Ben Sessa. I think it is called Psychedelic Renaissance. It's about this research. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's more that. Yeah, that's be more research focused, I think, the vibe, bringing together all the science that's being done, has been done and is being done, I think. But yeah, I've not read that personally.
Okay, the questions are rolling in. I've got an easy one. What's the current legislation regarding psychedelic use and research in the UK?
Sorry, what's the current status of
legislation regarding use and research in the UK specifically?
It's very, very. Oh, just to quickly echo, I think Ben maybe put it up. Michael Pollan, How to Change Your Mind, is a great book, particularly for people who are new to the concept of psychedelics. So, yeah, I'd like to echo that. So, yeah, the status of psychedelic research now. So it's very tough. And so psychedelics such as DMT, psilocybin, mescaline, are LSD, are all classified as Schedule 1. Class A substances. So the class system denotes kind of recreational usage, and the scheduling system kind of is more informing medical and clinical usage. So just to put this in perspective, drugs such as diamorphine or heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine are all Schedule 2, and that makes them sort of not too hard for a clinician or a doctor or a researcher to access, whereas psychedelics are Schedule 1, and that's a whole different sort of kettle of fish. Makes it very expensive and very challenging to access them. So you need, like, there's lots of regulatory hurdles and paperwork involved that can take years. There is sort of very strict controls over sort of having this stuff, so that the hospital or the center where you are requires its own license. The drugs need to be kept in a special safe with CCTV sort of cameras going 24/7, and the drugs require daily weighing on a very sensitive scale. So it's essentially like similar rules applying to what would be a radioactive isotope, I think. It's super strict. So it took the sort of imperial team like David Nutt and Robin Carhart-House and others quite a few years of regulatory back and forth with the government agencies and the Home Office to sort of get permission to do this research. And the Home Office, when the Home Offices or the government are challenged on the increasing weight of scientific evidence to say, like, it's probably, wouldn't it be wise to sort of loosen up the scheduling system and reclassify these things to make them more accessible for researchers, they sort of give the same copy and paste answer, which is like, there is no the evidence shows that these substances are harmful and that they destroy communities. And like there's just no, all the evidence that there is kind of sort of directly contradicts that. So unfortunately, the people currently in power who sort of dictate these rules and laws are totally clueless or actively ignorant against allowing access to these substances. Things are shifting and thawing in other parts of the world, but the UK, I'm afraid, is very backwards looking, and it's going to take more science and more time and more lobbying for things to change here.
Great. Okay, thank you. Somebody was asking about activism on drug policy reform, but sounds like you've touched on that there. So there's another question I wanted to go on to, which is also related. Some people who've used abused other substances and are considering using psychedelics as a way of helping them move through that therapeutically. Isn't that just replacing one with the other?
It's a good point, but it's more nuanced than that. I do wonder sometimes with ayahuasca and the ayahuasca using community that some people are sort of, they're swapping, not an addiction because ayahuasca is not addictive, but they're kind of swapping one thing for the other. And sort of, you know, it can be argued that that's much safer and less toxic than whatever substances people were previously abusing. But like, no, I think it's more complex than that. I think the research that's being done now shows that people can have, one or two supervised therapeutic psychedelic experiences, and they can sort of, move past addictions that they've had to other substances. It's important to note that, like, you know, this is occurring primarily, at least the research is, in a therapeutic context. So people are screened and they're prepared and they have follow-up integration support with these experiences. They're not just having a one-off experience. So, we know that psychedelics themselves, they are classical. The classical psychedelics are, they're non-toxic. They're non-addictive. You know, if anything, they're anti-addictive in the sense that they can treat addiction to other substances, and you're not likely to get addicted to them themselves, because you'll likely be in a rough time with them if you sort of try and abuse them like that potentially. I think there is great untapped, unexplored potential there in treating addiction with psychedelics. It was some of the more promising research that was being done back in the day in the 60s, 50s, and it is now starting up again, which is good to see.
Right, they're rolling in these questions. There's a question. Are there any studies on the effects on people with autism, who are in many ways most disconnected from others and the outside world?
Good question. I think, I don't know if it's happened yet, and I'm not sure if I thought I saw Ben Sessa's name, I think, pop up on the chat. So Ben might be better positioned than I to answer this, but I think there is research with MDMA and autism in an autistic population planned, actually, and it may be underway, but that's all I sort of know on that front at this time.
What do you think about microdosing with psychedelics? Could we deepen our connection to nature step by step with the use of psychedelics in our day-to-day life, even without very deep psychedelic experiences?
Interesting question. So the science on microdosing is it's still, I think, kind of up in the air. So there's been a few interesting studies recently, so the research is painting a mixed picture. There was an interesting study conducted by Imperial. I think it was a double blind like microdose placebo study, and people experienced what they felt were very real effects when they thought they'd been given a microdose, not when they'd necessarily been given a microdose. So it was saying that the deliberate act of taking something that you feel like is going to benefit you, because of the tremendous power of the placebo effect, it may well do that. But yet there's been more recent studies showing that very tiny doses of LSD can increase this neuronal growth factor called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is like a neuronal fertilizer and protectant. So that's really interesting. I think a study I read just earlier today that's come out showing that the study concluded that small doses of LSD can improve mood and cognition in some capacities, although it can also increase anxiety as well. So my view would be that yes, I think microdosing or small dosing with psychedelics could definitely increase one's at least appreciation for nature. But just harking back to what I was saying, like this connection to nature is something quite deep, you know, it's a deeply set trait, and it's the ego dissolution experience of the high dose psychedelics that can elicit this deep shift, at least this deep sustained and enduring shift in how we connect to nature and how we perceive nature. But for sure, like in a sort of like transient appreciation of nature, I'm sure that microdoses could have an effect, but I'm skeptical that it could like yield like a long-term shift in people's connection to nature.
Right. So you were talking earlier about things like ayahuasca and that kind of things, and there's a concern, good questions come up about how to acknowledge traditional use of psychedelics for raising an ecological awareness without falling into traps of cultural appropriation?
Yes. Interesting multi-angled question there. That's like, yeah. So I guess one of my responses to that, being mindful of the cultural appropriation and like stealing other people's ayahuasca, essentially, like, I have, you know, tremendous reverence for these shamanic cultures that have been using these substances. They have tried and tested approaches for doing these that have been tested over, you know, tried and tested over centuries, maybe millennia in some cases. So they really know kind of what they're doing. But like psychedelics are very malleable tools. I don't believe in like there's like a one size fits all approach here. And I would say that, you know, obviously in Mexico, the Mazatec and other indigenous groups there have been using psilocybin mushrooms for centuries as part of their practices. But we do have indigenous psilocybin mushrooms on our island here in Britain. So I would say that there is room, you know, we can maybe learn from other groups that are using these things and learn from their wisdom and their deep knowledge and experience. But we can develop our own independent practices using the psychedelics of our own land, you know, or if we want, looking back to Celtic practices, say, and incorporating something like that. So we don't need to culturally appropriate others. We can still have our own authentic usage, I think.
Right. So if you were trialing a psychedelic as a treatment for bipolar, would you have to cease yes. all other medical treatments such as lithium, SSRIs, et cetera, et cetera?
Good question. So it would very much be drug dependent. It would be, I think, hinging on whether there would be a potential dangerous reaction physiologically or psychologically by taking certain drugs. So I imagine lithium, yes, would probably contraindicated, and some other substances too. You know, for instance, in like modern studies, people can't be taking SSRI antidepressants or monoamine oxidase antidepressants or anything like that. So during the medical screening going into these trials, yes, certain drugs may pose a risk if mixed, not all necessarily, but some, and they will be screened out on a sort of case by case basis, I think. There's increasing sort of interest now in the potential of using psychedelics to treat bipolar. I mean, it is screened for in other modern trials, but there are some people with bipolar who do feel like they've benefited and would like to see some research happen. So yeah, things are shifting, and we'll see what happens in the coming months and years.
Great. Slightly to the side, but an interesting question all the same. Rachel writes, my childhood experience of delirium during illness was sometimes psychedelic and stayed with me into adulthood. Is medicating our children with things like paracetamol stealing these early initiatory experiences from them and impacting on society as they grow up?
Wow, yeah, that's an interesting question. There's been an interesting study. A friend did an article on paracetamol recently, because apparently they found that paracetamol may be affecting decision making in some way. I've not fully deeply looked into it, but it was quite a spooky and kind of worrying finding for something that's ubiquitously used as paracetamol. It was like it painted a slightly worrying picture. That's a really interesting question. There's just a case study here of Albert Hofmann, the LSD inventor and discoverer. So when he, in his younger days, when he was walking in the Swiss countryside, he described these kind of mystical unitive experiences while walking in nature, where the light coming through the trees would suddenly take on this luminous quality. And he just felt that he was absolutely at one with the natural environment he was in. And then he later said when he had his first LSD experience, it put him back in that same connected unitive state as he'd experienced when he was a child. So he had that sort of prior background experiential context to call on when he had his LSD experience, which I think is an interesting point and one that maybe gets overlooked in the whole mysterious discovery story of that. It's interesting. I don't know is the honest answer. It's interesting, but going back to the end of people's lives, there's a case made for, so people obviously on their deathbed or before they die, they can have near-death experiences and also deathbed visions. And these can be immensely therapeutic for people. And there's increasing sort of talk now in palliative care contexts that if you're sort of numbing people too much with heavy opiates and other things, the drugs can potentially block out these otherwise very beneficial experiences people can have at the end of their lives. So that's sort of semi-relevant to this, but I'm not sure about spontaneous sort of fever experiences, but that's really interesting.
Given all the research and the positive effects associated with psychedelics, looking forward, do you see psychedelics becoming more accepted, less demonized, and more accessible in the future? That's from Valeria.
Yes, I do. Things are already shifting, and it's going to take some time because, you know, psychedelics have still got cultural baggage attached to them from the 60s. I mean, it's interesting that currently at the current sort of focus of research now really is psilocybin, you know, the active compound in magic mushrooms, and as opposed to LSD, which had its day in the 60s, although it's sort of being researched a bit more sort of behind the scenes, I guess. But one of the researchers thinks that, you know, well, firstly, LSD is a lot, psilocybin is a lot harder to spell than LSD. And also, yeah, the cultural, political baggage attached to LSD that, you know, that it really kind of threatened the establishment. Like if you talk to someone like David Nutt, who heads the Imperial Group, his view of why LSD and psychedelics were criminalized is because they were like, they were a threat to the existing power, the political power structures. So the Vietnam War, people sort of, demonstrations and the civil unrest, it was sort of connected to that. And so the powers that be really kind of freaked out. And so wanted to sort of like, they thought, you know, Richard Nixon thought LSD made hippies. So if he stemmed the flow of LSD, he would like stem the flow of the counterculture to some degree. So I think there is a thawing around cultural, societal perceptions of psychedelics, and in scientific circles as well. I think there's a thawing as well. I think because, you know, we have all these mental illnesses like depression, which is on the rise, existential anxiety, death anxiety, you know, we're all going to die someday. Addiction, you know, these afflictions, post-traumatic stress disorder, these afflictions, we can't, there's a lack of existing really effective treatments. And psychedelics seem to be showing promise at treating all of these things. So I think it's fairly inevitable that they will become medically integrated and societally integrated. Like, it remains to be seen how that will play out. I'm a bit kind of have concerns about like the corporate pharmaceutical kind of model, like taking hold of psychedelics and sort of like, yeah, rebadging it as something and trying to force things through too quickly to make a profit margin. I don't know. I do have some concerns, but I think with time, yes, they're going to become increasingly accepted.
Brilliant. Any suggested readings on microdosing?
Yes. So there's a few things. So there's a guy called James Fadiman, who was one of the sort of psychedelic researchers from back in the day, who's still sort of active now. He's come up, I think he's got a book called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. And I think in there, he provides a protocol for microdosing. But if you want to delve more deeply into it, there's a professor, Torsten Passy, and he, I think earlier, sort of maybe last year, he released a book that delves deeply, specifically into microdosing, into the history and the science of psychedelic microdosing. So if you really want to sort of go deep, look up, yeah, type in Torsten Passy microdosing and see what comes up. That would be the go-to resource I think I'd recommend for that.
Brilliant. I think we're probably just going to squeeze this last one in. From Sessa, what do you think of the recreational use of psychedelics in, for example, festivals? Does that have an impact on the process of raising ecological awareness?
Yeah, good question. Psychedelic use in a naturalistic setting, in the wild, so to speak, which, let's be fair, is where most psychedelics are taken and will be taken. So it's interesting. A collaborator on a recent paper I've been writing, sort of bringing together all the literature on psychedelics and nature connectedness, Matthias Forsman, he did a 4-year, him and his team did a 4-year study, like a festival study, a naturalistic festival study, looking at psychedelic use, comparing it to other drug use and sort of looking also at sober, non-drug using people. And he looked at what kind of effects people were getting in the festival environment. So he'd previously authored a paper on psychedelics and nature relatedness and pro-environmental behavior as well, just to set the context. And he found that, yeah, psychedelic use, but not use of other substances and not sort of sober non-drug usage, psychedelic usage was associated with transformative experiences and increased social connectedness. I don't know if he looked at nature connectedness as well. I think he was interested in that study, in the interpersonal connection. So it showed that, yeah, even when psychedelics are used outside of the clinic in a kind of like natural setting, they can and do potentially have benefits. And it seems like, I guess, to some degree, people's friends and loved ones are sort of filling in the niche of the therapist in a sense, like they have support through the people that they're with. So there are still potential benefits from people sort of using psychedelics in that environment. Obviously, I have to say that, you know, there's obviously more risks as well, you know, it's but like, yeah, there can be definitely benefits. But no, it's an interesting question. And my hunch would be, having spoken anecdotally to people who've sort of not had any particular prior deep interest in nature, actually, like a single psychedelic experience can sometimes really change people, and they sort of turn on and tune in to nature's wavelength in a deep way. So my hunch would be yes, potentially yes.
Great. You've got the title of the paper you referred to, the one,
the Matthias Forsman one, is that?
Yeah,
I'm assuming. So yes, if you type in Forsman 2017, the paper is called Lifetime Usage of Classical Psychedelics Increases Pro-Environmental Behavior Through an Increase in Nature Relatedness. Something along those lines. But you'll get it on Google.
Brilliant. Okay. That's been so fascinating. We've had more questions for this session than any of other ones I've been on. So that's really exciting. I've had to just say that's enough now. We're running out of time. So I'm going to just show our sponsor's video in just a moment. Were you going to make a comment there?
Cool. No, that's great, Adrian. Thanks. I know my talk was not quite as long as I or probably you were expecting, but it's been fun to have the Q&A, actually. Yeah, it's nice to have the back and forth. So, yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, really helpful. So we'll have a video from our sponsors, then I'll come back to Sam just for a few closing thoughts on just one takeaway from this, or a way to become more embodied. So I'll give you some, just a, while I'm showing the video, you can have a ponder.
Cool.
Need any help, Adrian?
No, it's not quite working, is it? Are we all right?
There's no sound with it. So when you say in share screen at the bottom left, there is a checkbox that says share sound as well.
Yeah, I'm not doing this.
No worries. It doesn't matter.
Right. So it's a shame we didn't do that, but you'll okay, I love technology. I'd much rather work with people. So it's cool. It's Forest Without Frontiers. We play that sponsorship video in every session, and it's they're a lovely charity. They're working in Eastern Europe, planting lots and lots of trees. And we've actually had an interview with their founder, if you want to look that up. So Forest Without Frontiers, and we've got their link in the box there. So Sam, just a closing thought on how we can become more embodied.
Yes, I know. I was meaning to say, I know this is the embodiment conference, and embodiment didn't come up so much as a theme in my presentation. But yeah, it's important to note actually that part of the therapeutic integration practices that people sort of can do with psychedelics, and the therapeutic programs, it seems that psychedelics fare much better, or there's a much more powerful synergy when people use more kind of embodied body-oriented integration practices. So that's sort of like, yeah, that's an interesting thing to note, particularly things like psilocybin, I think, are more sort of like, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on in the body. You know, people always think it's all the brain and the mind doing stuff, but you're getting lots of stuff and stuff and realignments and vibrations and feelings coming from the body. And it seems, yeah, embodied integration practices following psychedelic experiences can definitely, they have a lot of potential. And it's still, you know, it's still early days in terms of them sort of being investigated, but they seem to sort of hold great potential.
Wow, what a great way to close. Excellent. Thank you so much, Sam. I've really enjoyed that, as I'm sure we all have.
Thank you. No, it's been really fun. Thanks a lot for having me.